Coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Everybody, how you doing? My, it's been a long time since I've been here in my beloved studio. It is so nice to be back from the road, right at 30 straight days on the road for work and speaking at the amazing Comic Palooza this last weekend. That's always fantastic. I love doing it. Thank you all so much for tuning in during all the amazing pre-records that we had. Thank you so much to all of our guests who took part in that. Everything from episode 75, which was, of course, the Falk Monster Festival coverage that we had, as well as episode 76 with Michael J.S. Carter and Gretchen Cornwall, episode 77, Dr. John Hall and Keith Sealand. And then, of course, tonight, we've got Dan Duke in our pre-recorded segment. Get well, Dan. He is apparently down with the COVID right now. So prayers for him and speedy recovery, my friend. But we are talking with Dan about the mystery of Jesse James, his apparently falsified death, his move to Texas. What happened to Dan and his mother when they began actively investigating their familial relationship with Jesse James here in Texas? That's a pretty wild story that goes into some pretty weird things that started happening to them. In our first segment, we will have Leslie Mitchell Clark on, talking about hypnosis, talking about alien experience. She is, of course, the author of Intersections, A True Story of Extraterrestrial Contact, as well as the owner and head of Lightworks Hypnosis. We will be talking with her about the world of hypnosis, how it can be used not only to better your life, but to change your life, to help get rid of different, I guess, really not only repressed things, but also traumas that happen to you. So interesting conversation this evening that we will be getting into with Leslie Mitchell Clark. We always love our conversations with her. Of course, while you are online checking out all the amazing work of Leslie Mitchell Clark, stop on by Curious Realm. That is where you can find all the episodes. That's where you can find the Knowledge Vault. That is where you can find the store. The store is where you can find all of our merch. That's where you can find all of the books by our guests that we have here on the show. That is also where you can follow us on social media and keep up with the Curious Realm group, which is where we bring the news of the week from every week. The news of the week is brought to you by the Curious Realm Facebook group. Stop on by, join the conversation, folks. Some of the articles that we have posted this week at a Business Insider: a startup is growing coffins made of mushrooms. They biodegrade in about a month and cost $1,000. Out of AP News, Florida police search for three gunmen who wounded nine at a crowded beach on Memorial Day. Out of dailymail.co.uk, new trove of Jeffrey Epstein emails reveals his powerful network. And out of fizz.org, new DNA testing technology shows majority of wild dingoes are purebreds, not hybrids, as previously thought. That is just some of the news that is fit to print out there, folks. Stop on by the Curious Realm group on Facebook. Join the conversation. Our conversation this evening is with our good friend and guest, Leslie Mitchell Clark. We will be talking with her about hypnosis, the paranormal, extraterrestrials, things like that. Welcome to the show, Leslie. How are you?
Oh, Chris, I am absolutely fantastic, and I am so pleased to be back on the airwaves with you. And I've got to tell you, I just love that last typewriter sound.
Oh, thank you.
That you had during the all the news that is fit to print. I mean, that's a sound that the youngins don't recognize now.
It was a torturous sound for me as a kid. Man, the whiteout was my friend. Let's just say that.
Yeah, whiteout. No one would even, that sounds like something inappropriate to say now.
Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds politically incorrect, doesn't it? Give me some whiteout. Oh, for God's sake, no. So.
Well,
but I remember being in typing class at about age 14. And can you imagine, you know, 30 kids going at it with those old Smith Corona office style analog, completely analog mechanical devices. Anyway, I love the sound. And oh, there's my book and a nice picture.
Well, and you know, it really is interesting, Leslie, whenever you start just to start our conversation of hypnosis, even your lulling of that sound. Not many people realize how deep hypnosis goes, how regular it is, how everyday it is. Even the idea of that sound mulling up so many feelings for you in and of itself is similar to the state of hypnosis.
Well, it is a state of, it's a light state of hypnosis. Really, Chris, most of us are walking around in a light state of hypnosis most of the time. And, you know, as you know, it was discovered in the more modern era of hypnosis that repetition was one of the big keys to embedding, you know, messages in the subconscious mind. So, you know, indeed, advertising, you know, pummels you. And, you know, after you hear an ad 40 times, you're going to go out and buy that $9.99 piece of plastic or whatever, you know, whatever it happens to be. But I do think that we all have a kind of a synesthesia. Now, science has said that they've picked out people who have it in exceptional degrees. And it does indeed seem rare when, you know, people hear music and they see colors. And that's what I'm talking about. It's a kind of a mashup of the senses. But in fact, that's how we perceive what we call reality. And those are the kinds of things. Smells are really, I'm sure you've experienced that yourself, where you'll go into a place and say, oh gosh, it smells like my grandmother's kitchen or something like that.
Oh yeah.
Smells are probably the most evocative. And these smells are simply, you know, transferred by chemical interactions into memory centers of our brain. And they are there to resonate. And they resonate in the subconscious mind. So, yes, we are all in a light state of hypnosis all of the time. And there are individuals who have taken advantage of that.
Oh, most definitely. And have even fully contributed to that, Leslie.
We
have to remember that we ourselves are fully, it begins with consent, and our consent to the system, our consent to whether it's something of ease, whether it's something, once again, the repetitiveness, makes something a rote habit. Make something to where you don't really have to think about it to make it happen.
Indeed. And once you believe something, both subconsciously and consciously, it will manifest. It will manifest. That's science. I don't consider that any really esoteric knowledge. That is a known thing. People can manifest illnesses. We usually see it, we recognize it more readily maybe in the negative, like you know, Munchausen by proxy syndrome or something of that nature. But we are capable of manifesting incredible things. In fact, I would go so far to say is that you know, the mind manifests reality reality does not manifest the mind. It is, we've been thinking of it in that we are more or less pinioned by our physical conditions that we can see in one little part of the spectrum, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, most definitely. And we tend to pigeonhole ourselves incredibly. We tend to pigeonhole our thoughts. We tend to really distill things down. And as I've begun to point out to a lot of people in the world, unfortunately, a distillative mentality, the only thing that comes from any distillation process is volatile content. That's it. When you get to that distillation mentality, instead of learning to see the forest and the trees, you can really start setting yourself up for, that monotonous mentality, which, puts you into almost a state of hypnosis where other things just kind of bounce off your brain.
Well, I think that's why we have a lot of substance abuse, too. There's a kind of a global ennui, you know, and people are looking for stimulation in, you know, I will just say temporary places. I'm not going to put a value judgment on people's experimentations, whether it's wrong or right. But I don't think narcotic stimulation is sustainable. Or should be sustainable for your health. So, but there are people who are adepts. I mean, they're just people like you and I who have a meditation discipline, who can even play with time. They can extend it. Because time is plastic and subjective. It is like gravity. In fact, gravity is an aspect of space-time. I know that Einstein was exploring that near the end of his life. And we don't even really understand gravity. But I do believe that it is in some type of relationship with space-time, which is why our visitors, our progenitors, our friends, our galactic neighbors are able to use craft that seem to defy our natural laws of gravity. But in fact, they're only using natural laws to create a different effect.
Oh, yeah, most definitely. And to look at that even now amongst what has been declassified, what has come out in even the questions to the Senate panels, everything else, it's leaps and bounds. It's pretty well not even to question that what we have seen and what has been disclosed to us is not that it's not known technology or not terrestrial, but my God, how did they get there? How did they get to that point without us knowing? And what got them to that point, which is, I think, where we start getting into that either otherworldly or time shifted technology that, as good people like Kathleen Martin talk about, how put off. The concept of the reason why three people in a group can see it and the other two can't is because those three people are specifically shifted into that vibrational state.
Yes. That is a very important thing to remember. But we all have the ability to shift in.
Oh, sure.
To perception. It's just that, you know, it's just like musical ability.
Yeah.
Some people, and I have long maintained that the one commonality amongst the, you know, the individuals that I work with who have had experiences or are ongoing experiencers or have been in the secret space program or what have you, the great coalescing bubble around these people is psychic ability. And I simply think that in many, many cases, the beings that we work with that care about us, that are involved, that maybe have contributed DNA or what have you, they're not as densely physical as we are a lot of the time. And they have come to completely rely on telepathy, or they use telepathy. They can speak, I believe, because they do speak when necessary, especially the more humanoid ones that are obviously related to us. But it is a universe of telepathy. And so people who can do it more easily, I think, are followed in family lines, sometimes taken and tested as infants. I mean, it's a whole thing. And, it reminds me of, say, you're Jane Goodall and you're out in the middle of Africa and you come across a bipedal hominid kind of being that where five of them in their whole tribe, you know, have a human like epiglottis and can form words. Well, wouldn't you spend your time working with those beings with whom you could communicate most easily?
Yeah. Well, and that is a very important part of what we bring up regularly, which is the fact of which part do you start researching? If you're out in the field and you see, let's say, a Bigfoot, you at least have the known quantitative of Bigfoot to deal with and regular phenomenology to look at and look for DNA evidence, hair, tracking, things like that. If you witness a portal, that's something different. Now you witness both at the same time.
Oh, yeah.
You are talking about a very, very slim. I mean, you were already talking a very slim to none chance of any kind of evidence being able to be garnered despite witness testimony. That's where I want us to start getting into the deep conversation here, Leslie, of hypnosis and recovery, because there are many, many cases out there now. I don't think that there are as many in the past of the shared phenomenological instance, like I saw a UFO and then there was a Bigfoot.
Yeah. Well, I think that we're talking about a certain amount of interdimensionality here.
Okay.
And it's my feeling, especially from a very good friend of mine, Mike Patterson, is the founder of Sasquatch Ontario, and he has some of the most compelling evidence in the form of vocalizations and other evidence. It's quite something, but
absolutely.
I feel that these beings are native to Mother Earth, but they are also, very special beings, and they are interdimensional because people have actually seen them going through portals and coming out. And, you know, it makes a tremendous amount of sense to me. Now, that's also the case of extraterrestrial beings. They can open vortices. Sometimes they can open them. And, I know there's been quite a bit of talk lately about, the work that Grant Cameron and other individuals are doing at Mount Shasta. And they use the term, do they call it a Zendra? That's the term they use. And apparently there are beings that come there regularly to communicate that are very humanoid. You know, they're Lyrans or Pleiadians. They look like us, essentially. And as a way to get us used to traveling in this way, they will come in on demand. Well, I don't want to say on demand is a terrible way to, but at request. And at a pre-designated time that is communicated psychically to the members of one of these groups that does this work, they will create a Zendra, which looks kind of like, or the way they present it, like a translucent box of some sort. And Grant Cameron explained that they can get like 30 people in there just to experience the feeling of the Zendra. And that's what's going on right now at Mount Shasta.
There has been some incredible, incredible work done, especially in the field of CE5, in the field of shared experience in that way, called experience. And once again, I believe that is the fact of, as Hal Puthoff said it in the speech that I literally saw him deliver, it's the fact of, the gentleman was able to pass through the skin of the craft because he vibrated at the same vibration.
Yes. That's how it works. And this can happen, you know, temporarily when people are taken, as you know, especially as children, sure. where they talk about flying through the roof or going out the closed window. It is entirely possible for the vibrational level of our cells to be adjusted so that we can slip through denser matter. And that is a real thing.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, it's not that incredibly hard to look at it and see that, yes, two mm-hmm. steps beyond, if you can get to the point of vibrating your molecules fast enough, yes, you will act like the Flash. If you can yeah. match the vibrational frequency yes. of a wall, you yes. will pass right through that wall.
That's science. That's known. That's known physics. And now you were asking about trauma. And one thing I will say, and this is, I really want your listeners to take this in so that we dispel fear. The vast majority of encounters that people come to me about or relate to me are positive and mind opening and sometimes healing. The vast majority. Now, that isn't to say that there haven't been horrific things that have happened. And yeah. I will have to reference, you know, that to the Zeta Reticulites and the Truman Agreement. There was an agreement made by Truman, which later is known as the Eisenhower Agreement, in which they, in exchange for technology, those presidents agreed to allow the Zeta Reticulites, who are from a binary star system. They're the same guys with Betty and Barney Hill,
yep.
those guys. And they would allow them to take genetic material they could no longer reproduce. Now, it was very misleading because not only they abducted many, many people and used them as incubators, took their ova, took their sperm. And these are very disturbing, awful experiences. And but the good news, if I could say there's good news, the good news is that they were limited to a certain time period, and the Zeta Reticulites obeyed the agreement and stopped these experiments after a certain period of time. So if I am working with someone this day and age now, who has had experiences like that, this is going to be a fairly senior person. And I don't encounter that very often. But most experiences are positive. And I will also say that the worst possible things that I have ever heard about being done to human beings have happened under the auspices of our secret space program. And the various guises that it appears in. But the worst things that I've heard are in these combined programs that we don't know anything about, who operate autonomously and who have a black budget and are now, you know, essentially running the show when the complete process is unelected. Now, the most profound PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder that I deal with is individuals who have participated in these programs, and particularly what we call the 20 and back, meaning that they serve for 20 years, you know, intergalactically or within our solar system, serve for 20 years, and then we're regressed back to the age of 18 or whatever, with repressed memories and a real effed up mind. So that is and you know, the governments, our Canadian government even admitted that they were involved in some very shady military stuff at the University of Montreal, where they were using mind bending techniques and giving them, you know, LSD and blah, blah, blah.
Oh, so they were fully cooperative with the U.S. government when it came to MK Ultra, when it came to numerous programs.
Yes. And the survivors of these programs have sustained psychological and sometimes physiological damage that we can't completely understand. They used trauma to teach young cadets how to bilocate. I have heard things that, well, the worst things I've ever heard have come from humans dealing with other humans. So we have a lot of work to do before we're going to be accepted into, Gene Roddenberry's United Federation of Planets. And I do actually believe that there is an organization like that. And we are just, we're just still mucking about. And I think there's a prime directive where the advanced beings can only help us so much. And we have to do our own work. And imagine, I mean, we have racism and sexism. We can't even get along amongst ourselves.
Yeah.
Can you imagine, the Corey Good. Yes. Can you imagine, they think we're a high risk.
Yes.
And
this is a case that I find very interesting. I can't not bring it up. I can't not talk about it. Would be people in my audience who would be very upset, because I was very upset when I found out about this.
I know.
It's not even a dirty secret or anything, but one of the things that I have done in my past is I was a former on-air producer for Alex Jones. Now, say what you want, folks. Believe what you want. However, the man has to be held actionable for his words.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a lot of calls to action on air, things like that, dealing with that. And that's well steps beyond the bounds of protection of the First Amendment. Mm-hmm. That is not covering things as the news. Now, Corey Good, come to find out. Now, as you were mentioning, secret space program, not denying that it exists, not denying that any of that is real. However, the case of Corey Good and the way he put it out, not real. He actively came out and said that in depositions. He has actively come out and said that in video deposition that we have played on this show. There was a good 8 hours of that where he literally called the other people who at least say that the blue avians, things like that, that he talked about, that were his meditation guides that he made up. Like, if they're saying they saw that, they are delusional. They're delusional people.
Mm-hmm.
And Corey, I'm not saying they're not. My question to you, much like for Alex, would be, at what point do you stop spoon feeding the delusion?
Yeah, no kidding.
That in and of itself is a form of PTSD. That in and of itself is a form of divergent mentality that you are feeding and can truly lead into, with some people, divergent mentalities, divergent personalities, all kinds of things. So,
yes.
even for him to have put it out there, there are some people of certain given mental faculty deficiencies is the most easy way I can put it, that would absorb that, and it would literally become part of their narrative and reality.
Oh, I know.
Part of their traumas, part of everything, Leslie.
Yeah, it's like Trump syndrome. They'll believe anything. Well, I think that I knew quite a bit of stuff about Corey Good before it came out in this way. Plus, I hate to say this, I hate to say it, but I just never believed him.
There was quite a bit that was tough pill to swallow. And
it was tough. And then, Chris, in all of these years that I've been doing this work with experiences, 20 plus years, I had never heard not one of my people talk about blue avians.
Yeah.
Not once. Now, I'm not saying that this is an endlessly creative universe. I'm not saying that these beings couldn't exist.
Sure.
I'm just saying that in the trenches here, in working with recovered memory.
Yeah.
I have never heard a reference to these beings. And then there was also a little funny thing that happened before all this came out, where he got into a big stink with somebody. He was trying to copyright, what was it? He was secret space program.
That is what the whole
all that stuff,
the whole rigmarole is about.
That started quite a while ago. So I just kind of the experiencer that I feel has the most credibility has got to be Captain Randy Kramer. And, you know, I've interviewed him a number of times, and, you know, his story is always consistent, and it's fascinating. If you've never had him on the show, I'm sure you would enjoy speaking to him.
I would love to have him on.
Oh God, I'll give you his contact info.
Please.
He's so practical and kind of matter of fact, and just so honest. He has tremendous credibility with me. Plus, he's also, you know, he's passed through his PTSD thing, and he's a big, you know, into meditation, what have you, but he's also teaching, and he teaches psionics, which is the name that he uses to describe the kind of psychoactive, telepathic, kinesthetic skills that are taught in the secret space program.
Interesting.
So there's I'll make sure to give you his contact info.
Yeah, because, would be great, because again, there were claims for years prior to Corey Good. I mean, the work of Dr. Mike Sala has been out there for a long time.
Oh yeah.
All sorts of things. So
absolutely. And we can even go back to we could go back to Valiant Thor in the 60s. I mean, there was a, you know, there, for those of your listeners who may not be aware, he was an individual. I believe he was claimed to be Venusian, but he looked like your regular insurance salesman kind of guy. And he came to he greeted, he was accepted in the U.S. government. And this, I believe, was during the Eisenhower period. I think, me, I believe it is. Anyway, he got frustrated. He was here for 3 years. And couldn't make any headway in ecological. They were offering us ecological technology, 0 point energy, all kinds of things that would have prevented the destruction of the earth that has happened since the 50s, coal mining, all of that shite. So, he just got frustrated, said, so I now think that, look, there you have it. There he is.
Yeah.
There's Valiant Thor.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is a very interesting thing, because it's this is why we're not going to have a landing on the White House lawn, because this disclosure is now a grassroots movement, and it is a gift from the internet that allows us to not only present ideas and interact with each other, but to communicate globally. And share information. So it's a real gift. This could never have happened in this way before the internet. By the way,
no.
I think every advanced civilization goes through a period of time like this.
Absolutely.
An AI tech. It's like training wheels to pure telepathy.
Yeah.
We have almost instant communication.
Yeah.
But, it's technology, with training wheels. So,
we really do have to, and number one, as long as we can keep the training wheels on, the better.
I agree. I'm not ready yet.
but like as the Mayan calendar and prophecies state, it's very much the day and night cycle, the idea of the day being the burgeoning of a technology and the night being its application. We have 101 mm-hmm. ways that we can apply that technology mm-hmm. for the betterment of mankind.
Yes.
And probably about 1,001 that we could use to the detriment of mankind and really advance things and go amazing places. But would it be detrimental or beneficial?
Well, we have, sometimes we don't always understand what's beneficial. And it's completely, I mean, my mother thought frozen vegetables were better than fresh ones. You know, I mean, if we came out of the 50s, I mean, you're a young thing, but I mean, I'm lucky to be alive.
They sure do cook faster.
Yeah. Between polio and the frozen vegetables, and I don't know, man. But but I think that people are waking up and becoming aware in a wonderful way that is not frightening. It's none of this. This is all meant to be natural, natural. And, you know, I have to wonder because this one of the things about planet Earth, I think, is so interesting. And maybe it's one of the reasons why the ETs are so interested in us is because we have such a diversity of development amongst bipedal, Homo sapiens sapiens. We have, you know, we've got Charles Manson and we've got Hitler and then we've got, you know, other, we've got Evolve, we've got Mother Teresa. I mean, we have a huge spectrum of development.
Yeah.
And I often think they talk about moving into the fourth or the fifth dimension. Do we all go? How does that work?
And, you know, when you start looking at ancient texts, religious texts, things like that, that, that literally talk about exactly that, Leslie, that ain't all of us going.
No, it must be a question of perception. Like, for instance, this is one of the experiencers I work with. She's been involved with this particular group of ETs who are very much like Pleiadians. They're very humanoid looking, and she was being taken in almost kind of a little shuttlecraft for, you know, a trip into outer space. And she said to her guide, she said, "Can you show me the planet where you're from, where you live?" And she said, "Well, the planet is right there," and pointed to an area, but said, "You're not able to see it right now." Mm. Which, again, you know, our universe is teeming with life, not only in this third density, this crude slogging about meat suit kind of thing, but in other various subtle layers of vibration. There are other, we would have a whole different view of our, you know, of our solar system if we could see it in that way. I think it must be reflected in ancient knowledge somewhere, maybe in mandalas, the interdimensionality of it all.
We are a bubble in a layer of suds in the universe. That's what we are. When you're talking about the number of universes, the number of dimensions, everything else, it's literally like looking at a layer of suds in a sink. And we are one bubble amongst that. That is made of hundreds of thousands of bubbles.
That's right.
It's a meniscus that separates us. People tend to forget that the spectrum that we know, the spectrum that we see and that we hear, is a very minuscule thin slice of the ultraviolet spectrum.
That's right. A thin slice.
Very thin slice.
And most animals on the planet have a bigger chunk of that. They can see, but have you ever had any paranormal investigators on your program
who have
been working with the ultraviolet? Is it the ultraviolet spectrum cameras? Is that what I'm trying, where they have really able to capture incredible phenomena? I saw one that was being used at Gettysburg, and it was like there were soldiers walking all over the bloody battlefield, literally bloody.
Yeah.
And it was simply that they were in the infrared spectrum, I believe, or the ultraviolet. Is it the ultraviolet spectrum or is it infrared?
Most cameras that folks have like that are infrared cameras. But there are some very, very expensive UV cameras out there, things like that. But most of the chips that you see and everything out there are made for light amplification, which would amplify infrared faster.
Right. So that we can perceive it with our little rods and cones.
Yeah.
So,
But it is some remarkable stuff. And like, I even have a thermal camera, and you can find some pretty remarkable things with heat signatures and stuff like that as well. And once again, that is all within a range of spectrum that we cannot see.
Yes. So true. So the ability to see paranormal stuff that some people have, and I will come out to your peeps today that, you know, I've always seen stuff all of my life. It was inherited from my grandmother, my Swedish grandmother. Her grandmother before her was like a kind of a medicine woman for the Lapland tribe. So I know that it comes down through the maternal line for me. Now, my sister feels stuff, but she doesn't see anything. But I have had more figures appear to me, and sometimes they look very solid. Sometimes they are, you know, as Dan Aykroyd would say, free repeaters. Sometimes they're merely imprints on the atmosphere, and there's no consciousness there. It's just like watching a movie, you know. So because I think we can imprint things in that way on the atmosphere. I do. I think I believe in the stone tape theory. I think we can absolutely imprint trauma or moments of high emotion on the ethers, as it were.
Oh, sure. Sure, absolutely. And that is one of the concepts that I brought up numerous times. Even when you're talking about it, investigating a quote known location, and going in an amped state of mind, you could, just like Hal Puthoff put forward so many decades ago in his first work that led to the ideas of remote viewing, the idea that the scientist at home thinking about his experiment is adversely affecting his experiment.
Yeah.
You could be adversely affecting your clean space as you walk in for that paranormal investigation just by thinking about, what am I going to do on that paranormal investigation?
Yeah.
What might I catch?
Yeah.
And that's something that we phenomenologically have to take into consideration when doing science, when going forth and trying to bring about proof of these things, Leslie.
Yes, it is. And the technology is only helping. I mean, look at the We Connect technology now.
Yeah.
It's using to perceive spirit forms. And, you know, it's a visual representation. And of course, all of the various like lexicon based gadgets that we have, where the discarnate entities can actually use a dictionary and communicate. So we're of course in the areas of our completely wrong ideas about history, we have the completely twisted up stupid timeline. Now we have, you know, we have LIDAR, and we're able to pinpoint and investigate huge structures that were never seen before, that were hidden by the jungle. So we are curious people. I think that's one thing, you know, there was a whole Star Trek episode about that, wasn't there, where they, we are so curious, and there's nothing stopping us now. Technology is a tremendous help. And even in mainstream media, if you, even without subscription television, you know, if you look at the amount of programming that is metaphysically and ufology wise focused.
Yes.
It's huge. You know, when I was a kid, what did we have? We had the Twilight Zone.
Well,
that
is quite literally a topic that we have discussed with numerous people. The idea of that soft disclosure concept, the idea of, yes, preparing the mind and people for, well, the technology came from somewhere, folks, but we've got to put it on a shelf.
Yeah.
It's the only way that you're going to make the billions in black budget funds that were diverted to reverse engineer the technology actively mm-hmm. pay off. So in order to do that, yeah, you've got to prepare people. You have to get them used to the concept, even people that may not have been considering the concept. Mm-hmm, and the mm-hmm. more every day you make it, the more water cooler talk there is about it, the more discussion around a Thanksgiving turkey of, man, do you see that crazy show that's out there now? The easier it is to swallow. Literally.
Indeed, that's absolutely true. So the disclosure movement is a grassroots movement utilizing new media primarily, but also straight ahead accepted media.
Yeah.
And people are opening their minds. And I think it resonates with everyone. I think that the human population has been greatly underestimated.
Yes.
I think because the presence of ETs is actually, it's in our culture. We actually know it. And there are some, you know, there are some individuals on this planet who could probably trace their ancestry all the way back to the Anunnaki, beings with O negative blood and this, that, and the other. I mean, they physically interacted with us. A number of races did, I believe. That's why we have our, we have diversity of appearance.
Yeah.
So, you know, it couldn't have been just, you know, these, you know, sort of European looking guys. Although, interestingly enough, in our modern DNA research, this is very uncomfortable for the Egyptian government. They hate this, but it's now been determined that the Old Kingdom Egyptian mummies are all European.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you know, and you've seen pictures of the red hair. You've seen pictures of this, you know, but apparently, you know, they are European. They are not Semitic. They are not Arabic. They are not Egyptian.
Interesting. Interesting. Yeah. Wow.
And there's going to be more. There's going to be a lot more DNA revelations to come, I'm sure, once we understand it better and we have the technology to take a micro pin worth of DNA and get a whole picture. It's amazing things we're going to see. And it may be gentle and it may take longer than we would have liked, but.
And it will be traumatic for some people. It will be, there's a reason why, NASA brought aboard 12 theologians.
Yeah.
To discuss the topic, these are things that even when you scratch the surface like an archaeologist with a trowel, you're going to disturb a lot. You're going to shake a lot of pillars of faith and belief of people that may not even know that they believe in something, Leslie.
Maybe so. But, you know, even the Pope has come out.
Oh, sure.
And said, you know, and that's, those are.
They came out a while back and said that any existence of aliens would not change the salvific grace. It would not change sufficient grace within the soul of mankind, that there is nothing within Catholic teaching that would be separated should that become the truth.
Yeah. So there is progress. I think, you know, unfortunately, you know, we will always deal with the fear factor and we will always deal with the lack of education.
Well, that's where people like narrow
belief systems, you know, that are narrow belief systems.
Well,
see, even most of the Abrahamic religions, you know, have, you know, when I do my little talks about, you know, ET interaction, I mean, all of this goes way back into the Old Testament. And I mean, this has happened and it's written about very, credibly, you know, but there were encounters all the time.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think this is something that we instinctively understand, but we have forgotten, I guess would be my point. And I think that when the helpful brothers and sisters or cousins or whatever, however we want to think of it, when they do make themselves known, recognition will resonate in us. And part of our DNA that has been dormant will start to wake up.
Yeah. I think that part of that is already starting to wake up, Leslie. Mm-hmm. And I think that there is a huge shift in understanding and consciousness, quite literally all over the world right now. It is phenomenal and remarkable to see the acceptance of people, and even people that I've known for decades having conversations that they would have never had. About topics that they would have never had a conversation about 10 years ago.
Indeed. And the amazing kids that are coming into the world. My kids are grown now, but my eldest son, when he was very, very little, not even in school yet, maybe 3, 4, he said to me, you know, Mommy, the body is just a costume for the soul.
Oh, wow.
And I hadn't indoctrinated him in any religion at all. I mean, you know, the body is a costume for the soul. I said, yes, that's right, Chris. His name is Chris, too. Said, that's right. But I mean, out of these little brains, they've come in with you know, specialized skills, I think.
Oh, most definitely.
They're here for a reason.
Yeah.
These really smart kids who now they're coming up and they've grown up in a global world that's connected by the internet. They don't have racism. They don't see countries as separate. They have a different point of view than we did as kids simply because of technology.
Well, and because of open minds, because of that technology, exposure to new thought forms.
Yes, yes. Exposure to new things. That's exactly right. It's not the tech itself. It's the opening of the consciousness.
Yeah.
And we could, you know, I could only open so far by watching movies.
That's it. Leslie, I want to thank you so much for your time as always. Let everybody know. Let everybody know where they can go, because you've actually got an event coming up in the UK, the Welsh UFO Conference coming up, the UFO Paranormal and Spiritual Conference. People can go get tickets for that if they are in the UK. It is over near West Uck Lighthouse. Tell everybody a little bit about that and where they can go to keep up with all of your work and new books coming out, everything else.
Well, wonderful. Well, yes, I'm going to be there at the Welsh UFO convention. And it's one day. It's June 10th, and it's very reasonable. I think it's from £10 to £30. It's very reasonable. And they have a wonderful lineup of speakers who are going to talk about an array of things. And I'm going to be talking about the work that I do with experiencers. And I hope you can come. And anybody from your listening audience who happens to be there on June 10th, who says the name of your show, Chris, I will give you a free book, a free copy of Intersections.
You cannot beat that, folks. It is actually an amazing book. That is what we had you on about the first time you were on.
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah. Well, we've got coming up in the pipeline, I'm beginning work on the follow-up to this, really, which I'm calling Midwives of Disclosure. And I will most likely collaborate with Wes Roberts again, but it's going to be a compendium of the really important movers and shakers in the disclosure movement. Everybody from Michael Tellinger to, just a whole lineup of who's who. Kathy Marden, I'll get her.
Fantastic.
And so I'm hoping that will be of appeal for anybody who's interested in this subject. So anyway, there you go. And if you want to, if anyone out there would like to reach me directly, I always return emails. If you just if you just have a question or what have you, you can email me at Leslie@lightworkhypnosis.com or on my website, lightworkhypnosis.com. There's a there's a form there that's very easy and user-friendly, and you can just fill that out, and I'll get that. And you can find me on Facebook as Leslie Mitchell Clark or Lightwork Hypnosis. And there is also, you can also find me on Facebook as Our Contact TV. I've had a podcast for, I don't know, about 20 years or so. And
yeah.
And it's a lot of fun. One of these days, you're going to have to step out of the chair there and come be my guest.
Anytime. I
really?
I would love to. That would be fantastic.
Oh, marvelous. We'll make that happen.
Yeah, most definitely.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you for just spending this time and asking such insightful questions. And I just look forward to the next time that we can get together.
Absolutely. Same here. Let's definitely make it a much more regular thing than it has been. I always love our conversations whenever we have you on. So
Thank you. You
have a great evening. We will make sure to send a link to you whenever all this goes out, which will actively be here in a little while. So,
okay. Thank you, Chris. Thank
all
you
right.
so much.
Take
and
care.
And you take care.
All
okay.
right.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye. Man, always great to hear from Leslie Mitchell Clark. After our commercial break, folks, coming up, we will be talking with Dan Duke. He is not only an author and researcher into the world of Jesse James and his supposed death, actual fake death and life continuing here in Texas. He is also a family member, and we will be finding out some strange happenings that occurred with Dan when he and his mother began investigating their family lineage and connection to Jesse James here in Texas. Stay tuned for that, folks, right after these messages. With the rise in attention to the health benefits of cannabis and cannabinoids, including CBD, True Hemp Science has become one of the premier providers of full-spectrum CBD and CBD-related products. Using a proprietary spagyric process, True Hemp Science extracts maximum benefit from the whole hemp plant. Buds, leaves, stems, seeds, even roots. Every part of the plant is used and then reused to formulate a rich, complex profile of CBD, CBD derivatives, and terpenes guaranteed to provide the relief and benefits you need daily. Visit TrueHempScience.com to experience the best CBD oils, edibles, and topicals on the market today. And use code CURIOUS7 to save 7% off your entire purchase of $50 or more and get 2 25-milligram CBD cookies or brownies free. That website again is TrueHempScience.com and the code is CURIOUS7. Have you considered starting a podcast? Looking for a way to make your business a voice of authority in an industry? Then Podcast Cadet is the solution for you. Whether starting a podcast for yourself, your brand, business, school, church, or just plain fun, Podcast Cadet is here to help you navigate the waters of the podcast industry. Specializing in one-on-one consultation and training with industry professionals in fields ranging from podcast technology and editing to distribution, monetization, and even social media strategies. Podcast Cadet tailors their services to the specific needs of you and your podcast. Do you already have a podcast and trying to find ways to engage and grow your audience? Sign up for your Podcast Cadet audit today and let us help you explore new and exciting ways to leverage your content and elevate your podcast brand to whole new levels. From consultational workshops to affordable podcast production and maintenance packages, Podcast Cadet is your one-stop shop for everything podcast-related on the internet. Visit PodcastCadet.com today to sign up for your consultation or training, and use code CURIOUS20 to save 20% off your entire purchase. That website again is PodcastCadet.com. Curious Realm Podcast is your source for the latest and greatest news and events in the world of the paranormal, esoteric, and forbidden knowledge. And there's no better way to spark the conversation than with items from the Curious Realm store. Choose from fan favorites like hoodies, mouse pads, coffee mugs, and more. Buy books and items from your favorite Curious Realm guests. Get your hands on the latest gear for paranormal investigations and experiments we discuss on the show. Open your web browser and stop on by the Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to buy the latest Curious Realm wear and out-of-this-world gifts for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store. Well, hello everybody, and thank you for staying tuned through that commercial break. We are so thankful to all of our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. We love True Hemp Science. Chris Lynch comes on the show occasionally. Whenever I get back from all these pre-recorded episodes, I've talked to him about coming in the studio. He has some fantastic new gummies out there. Stop on by and check them out. TrueHempScience.com is the website. Curious7 is the code that you want to use to save 7%. But right there, the Moon Dust Gummies. I am telling you, those are incredible. Stop on by and check them out, folks. I have used them. I found Chris at a farmer's market here in Austin, and we struck up a conversation. I'd been trying to get my mother. My doctor had recommended me try CBD for my travel anxiety, and I had such a success with it that I wanted to try some for my mother. And I found Chris, and I was like, oh, I'll give your stuff a shot. Hands down, the best stuff I've ever tried across the country from any dispensary. So check them out, folks. TrueHempScience.com. Curious7 is the code that you want to use. Our guest in this segment is the amazing Daniel Duke. He is the author of Secret History of the Wild West, Outlaws, Secret Societies, and the Hidden Agenda of the Elites, as well as Jesse James and the Lost Templar Treasure. That is the copy that I have right here in my hand. Welcome back to the show, Daniel Duke. How are you doing?
Thanks for having me on. I'm doing great. It's an honor to be on your show.
Oh man, it's an honor to have you back on the show. I'm sorry that we did not get to connect. Unfortunately, the event that I was going to be going to Marshall for ended up not happening this last year, the Bigfoot Film Festival. So I did not get to meet you in person, but now you live so much closer. So that opportunity is right up the road and mere beers away, my friend.
That's true. So, sounds good to me.
I'm happy to have you on tonight because coming up soon, we will be having our good friend Gretchen Cornwall, who is featured regularly on The Curse of Oak Island for her work in the world of Templar research, doing work into research into the Knights Templar in Europe and beyond. And Your book, Jesse James and the Lost Templar Treasure, very interesting. Let's begin with, how did you become such a Jesse James fan and researcher, Dan?
Well, it started with my late mother, Betty Dorsey Duke, and she spearheaded the research proving that Jesse didn't die as history stated. Traditional history claims that Jesse James was shot in the back of the head by one of his fellow gang members, Bob and Charlie Ford. And that was the end of Jesse in 1882. The facts are they didn't shoot Jesse. They shot Jesse's first cousin, Wood Height, who bore a strong resemblance to Jesse. Jesse was in Texas when it happened. And the wild thing, I wish my late mother could have seen it. She'd always said, wouldn't it be amazing if we could find a photograph showing Jesse at his funeral? Because there were legends that he attended his own funeral. And, you know, we thought, yeah, that'd be amazing. It sounded like a pipe dream. And a few years, literally just a couple of years after my late mother passed, my sister found a photo, and it shows Jesse standing next to his mother, Zerelda James, and Frank down in the holding the casket up with their cousin Wood Height. Jesse was at his own funeral, and we have a photograph of it. That just blew me away. It blew us all away. I just wish my mom could have seen it. But that my late mother, she spearheaded the research. When it came to the treasure side of it, while she was doing the genealogy and with the DNA work and all of that, and working with forensic photograph experts, I would get a little extra time, and I would start trying to, you know, I would work on the treasure maps that were passed down through the family. And that's where the first book came about.
Now that's the part, that's the turn in the story that I love. I mean, number one, not just the fact that, you had this family history and story of connection to Jesse James to begin with, via actual relation. But the story of him faking his death and then your family having treasure maps.
The diary, we have his diary from 1871 through 1876. And in the diary, there's mentions of, he wrote it. He never said I buried treasure here, but he would say, he would give clues, different things. They used to put treasure maps on calf hides, and he would grain a calf hide. It was part of tanning the hides. Mm. He would mention that. And then he had a lot of encrypted writings in his diary. And I didn't mean to interrupt, but
No.
Along with the treasure maps was the diary. And that's the diary is worth its weight in gold, in my opinion.
That's
just for historic value.
That's phenomenal that you by chance, has there been any forensic handwriting analysis done on the diary? I mean, I'm sure that there are. I mean, he was a legal landowner at one point, so I'm sure that there's deed to his property that could be matched, all kinds of things.
Yeah, there was a letter written. My sister knows the name. My sister's at work right now. So,
call her,
Dan. She literally left an hour ago. I need to call her.
Conference her in right now.
I wish I could remember the lady's name. I think the lady's first name was Joan. Joan Christo. I believe that was her name. She was a handwriting analyst. She's done work for law enforcement and other people. She verified that a known signature, we'd found a copy of a known legitimate signature from Jesse James. He'd written a letter about a crime he had allegedly committed, and he wrote a letter and signed it in his name. That handwriting matched with the handwriting in the diary and his signatures on other papers we have that were passed down.
Wow.
So it's like one piece of evidence. That's fine, but that's not going to convince anybody. And when you have to change, when you've got established history saying this, it takes a lot to It takes a lot to change established history.
Well, and we discussed that last time you were on, and we discussed that a little bit with Craig Wolheater whenever we had him on here recently. The even the idea of, like, there are old timers and people, even new timers in Falk, that want nothing at all to do with the Falk monster. They don't want Falk monster traffic. They don't want that crazy in their backyard. And like we discussed last time you were on, the town that Jesse James died in, that's pretty much their claim to fame. Like that would be like, welcome to, that's like on their welcome board as well as how many people live there, you know? Home of Jesse James Death House, you know?
Exactly. Like that's up in Missouri, and he actually didn't die there, but they claim it, and they get a lot of tourist dollars from that.
Well, and that's just it. Like you're saying, by all evidence that you have found, forensic evidence, forensic photography evidence, forensic handwriting evidence, Jesse James did not die. And what happened when you approached the town with that information?
They vehemently denied. They didn't want to talk about it. They didn't want to. Yeah. And this was my mother first contacted them. We thought we were so naive in the beginning. We thought they'd be excited to know.
That
Jesse. Yeah. He wasn't shot in the back of the head. And that's the last thing they wanted to hear.
Yeah.
And this was 98 or 1999. Mom had called them. They hung up. I mean, it was a real quick, short answers. And it was good day, ma'am. And they hung up. Wow. And then it just got worse from there. But I thought, why would they do that? It didn't make sense. And then we found out just the James Farman Museum alone was bringing in $7 million a year. And that was in 98 and 99. I don't know what they're bringing in now. I haven't checked it, but I think money played a large role, along with, I guess, bragging rights. Some of the guys loved, you know, some of that crowd loved bragging that, you know, they were descended from Jesse, and they actually weren't. They were cousins, but they weren't descended.
Jesse. But that's exactly what I'm saying. Like when you have a town who, once again, like my family comes from Mamou, Louisiana, Daniel, and one red light town. It is known as the home of Cajun music, where Cajun music was invented. Now, come Mardi Gras, that town goes from one red light population of a couple thousand to about 20,000 people for about a week and a half. It gets insane.
Wow.
And there are businesses on Main Street, my man, that are open for a week.
Yeah.
They're open for 10 days out of the year. They make all their money in 10 days.
Wow.
They're done. Fred's Lounge, where Cajun music was born, is open on Saturdays.
Yeah.
That's it.
I agree. Yeah, I know what you mean. After when I was director of tourism up in Marshall, they're the home of boogie woogie music.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, you know, this is something I don't know why they've never capitalized on.
Yeah, much like Texas swing, things like that. That is.
Yeah.
And it's one of those. If they found out that that wasn't the case. If they found out that. No, Cajun music actually started up the road in Opelousas.
Yeah.
Not in Mamou, not in Big Mamou, but, you know,
it would be Opelousas.
It would change everything dynamically.
Yeah.
Business wise, everything
economically.
The motorcycles would not come through town on Saturdays.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
so money plays a huge role. In it. And then right up the road from Kearney, Missouri, where Jesse James was, you know, he was born there. He grew up there. But right up the road is St. Joseph, Missouri. And that's where Jesse allegedly died. And they make a lot of money. That's a very poor town. And that, a lot of their money comes from tourist dollars that people going to visit the house where Jesse was allegedly killed. And he wasn't killed there. And that's why they fight it.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And, you know, much like we talk about regularly on the show, whether you're talking Bigfoot, paranormal, UFO, UAP, there are people. There are researchers who've made their careers disproving. There are researchers that have made their careers with hypothesis and theory that is now being disproven by science. And what are you going to do?
And we've run across people like that. You've got egos that get involved. It's their career has been based on a lie. Egos on top of that, it's the full gamut. All types of emotions and reasons fall into play for that. But when it comes down to it, they cannot argue the facts. And we've even got DNA proof, more DNA proof than traditional history has.
Wow.
Showing that mom is a definite relative of Jesse James. It's not through 23andMe. This is through a guy who does work for the San Antonio, different cities in Texas, the DPS, Texas Rangers, and the FBI.
Oh,
so
wow.
He knows what he's doing.
Now,
Go ahead. Oh, it's interesting watching their reaction. You can tell them, and this happened for years. Mom would try to, she would talk to them online. And it was usually through a forum like Gen Forum, which is owned, I think, by Ancestry.com now. But it turned into such a circus, they ended up banning the forum. And it was just ended. But around the time the death threats, they sent death threats to my late mother. They threatened to kill my mother, me, my sister.
Death threats.
Yeah. The FBI got involved and finally put a stop to it. So that was good. And the guy they caught, the group behind it had paid this man and promised him all kinds of things. They paid the man to make these threats to try to scare mom off, and it didn't work. But then when he got caught, when the FBI knocked on his door, he named everybody involved, and he apologized to my late mother. Mm. It got really weird.
People honestly do not understand sometimes the depth to which some of these communities go. And the extreme to which some followers will go. Like you said,
it's
death threats, some, things like that.
Yeah, it's like a cult mentality in a lot of ways.
Wow. And I mean, just to speak to that, I want to say maybe it was on Rumble. In your last appearance, there was a gentleman that had a comment that was, oh, he's utterly wrong, you know. He's not related to Jesse James. I'm like, okay, I guess all that DNA evidence is just poof. Like, I don't know. Yeah. I've read the book. There's quite a compelling story here, and quite a decent heap of evidence, comparatively to literally just colloquial accounts.
Well, yeah, we've got the DNA evidence, and then we've got the photographic evidence, which has been verified by various unrelated, and we didn't pay for it either, which is another important thing. Texas Department of Public Safety Forensics Lab, they verified that our photos matched known photos of Jesse and his family members.
Wow.
The Austin Police Department Forensics Lab, they did the same thing, verified our photos. And then a group out of New Jersey, at the time they were called Visionics, then they were purchased by Identics or something like that. They were world leaders in facial recognition technology and sold their programs, their software, to the Pentagon and to international airports around the world. That was another thing I was so grateful my late mother took care of. She went to the best people she could find, and those groups she found were some of the best in the world. So it's DNA, it's photographic evidence, handwriting analysts, just the whole gamut. It's too much evidence to just discount, and they try to discount it. They won't. When they ask you a question and you answer it, their tactic online, especially online, they would ignore the answer and just keep asking the same questions.
Mm.
And it never made any sense. It got to where it was a waste of time. I told my mom, just talking to them, period, is a waste of time. Why bother with them? Just write the books.
Yeah. Yeah. And well, because at some point you've got to stop asking permission and just do it.
Yeah.
And it's one of those, it's a topic that it's not like making a documentary about somebody and possibly getting sued or anything like that. Like, even has the city, the claims Jesse James' death or anything like that ever attempted suing you for your work, for your books? Anything like that,
never,
for like defaming their city or, you know,
they never did that.
Okay.
I don't know. We expected it, but it never happened. And well, when you've got more evidence than they have, that's probably one of the main reasons it didn't happen.
It's a little hard to refute it when you have it. And that's exactly what I brought up to the gentleman. I was like, feel free to go purchase his book. Like,
which is exactly why they resorted to death threats. They couldn't win. They couldn't win fairly. They didn't have the evidence that we had. And I guess it frustrated them to a point they resorted to death threats.
And, it's interesting to me that they would resort to death threats over that, but not for treasure maps.
No.
Knowing from the books that you're holding treasure maps. Nobody made threat to like, hey, give me the maps or else, you know?
Yeah. And on the treasure maps, that first book I wrote, I'd mentioned before it was published, I didn't know my publisher had contacted Grandmaster of the Knights Templar, the current Grandmaster of the Knights Templar. And they asked, they contacted him and he wrote a glowing endorsement of my book. And that his endorsement of my book, I thought, my God, this ties in with, you know, masonry way back in the day. And it was the best compliment I could have ever had. He wrote a glowing endorsement for my book and said that basically I had cracked part of the code dealing with the treasures from the temple in Jerusalem. And I couldn't have had a better compliment than that. That made my day. It made everything worth it. You know, all the trouble. But
interesting. Well, yeah, because now let's start getting into that, because once again, like you said, you've got coded entries in his diaries.
Mm-hmm.
You've got references to such things, and then you have maps. How do you go about beginning that decoding process, Daniel?
Well, the codes on the maps were the easy part. Actually, the map was just a geometric design written on a piece of paper with a. It had dollar signs written, and had other things written, just different symbols. But the codes, it took a little while to crack it, but it didn't take too long. It was actually just substitution for numbers for letters. And he would do it with the alphabet going forwards and backwards, and he would mix it back and forth. But eventually we cracked it. You know, it was so much money in silver, so much money in gold. And also another amount of money in greenbacks that he called them greenbacks that he had buried. It was after 1900. But the problem was it was just a geometric figure. It wasn't a topographic. There were no topographical markings. You know, like on the movies, you see a 40 paces from the old oak tree.
Yeah, yeah.
There wasn't anything like that. It was just a geometric figure, and I guess you had to have been in the know to know where to start. And that's what it kept me awake many nights for years, so just off and on. Every time I thought about it, I thought, where could it be? And then I came across information about the Knights of the Golden Circle. They were a pro-Confederate group, a secret society. During the Civil War, they had a template, a treasure template, and I'm kind of jumping ahead of myself.
They were
a secret society during the Civil War who their main goal during the war was to thwart and slow down Union troop movements. Any way they could. They would blow up bridges, tear up railroad tracks, all kinds of stuff. So that was their goal during the war. After the South lost the war, they remained in existence, allegedly, and their main goal switched from that to gaining as much wealth as they could any way they could in order to fund a second civil war. And, you know, I had no reason to disbelieve this, but finding a list, there's a lot of people out there who claim, you know, Jesse James was a member, Albert Pike, all these different people. But there's no proof. That no one has ever come up with proof that all of these alleged. And I think they do that as a way of adding legitimacy to whatever their story is. I had, you know, at the time I thought, okay, maybe this is true. And they had a treasure template that I'd found on treasure hunting forums and in a couple of books also. So I thought maybe the template works. And I got, you know, I started researching it. It actually did work, but I found later it wasn't a Knights of the Golden Circle template. It was a Masonic template. I'm cutting this real short. I'm trying to figure out the best way to explain it. The Masonic template, it came into existence long ago, and I still to this day don't know exactly who it was who designed the template. But you can find the same design on like the Temple Church in London on an old Knights Templar monastery. There's the Western door in London on the Temple Church has the template, the treasure template on the door. It's a wooden door with wrought iron designs on it, and the design matches the template. And it goes, there's a lot. I'm sorry about that. I'm getting tongue tied.
That's okay.
There's a lot more examples of that. But when I found out about the template, I thought, okay, Knights of the Golden Circle. I have no reason to doubt that Jesse would have been in it. He fought for the South, although he was a guerrilla, and the reason he fought was most likely not political. He was 14 when he started fighting, and it was mainly because for revenge. Guys from Kansas rode onto his farm. They beat him severely, broke his jaw, all kinds of stuff. They pushed his pregnant mother around and hung his stepfather. They didn't kill the stepfather, but he had brain damage from then on. And that was Dr. Reuben Samuel. These atrocities hit people. And I can see a 14-year-old boy who in his day, it was a rough area. It was the edge of the Western frontier.
Yeah.
And you had to, you know, there's a lot of rough stuff going on. When that happens, I could see why he wanted revenge. He tried to join the Confederate Army so that he could get revenge. He was too young. They turned him away. And Quantrill's guerrillas accepted him, and that's where he got his start during the war.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to tie this back into the template.
I think it ties in very well to the template whenever you're talking about his guerrilla work and literally the stated purpose of the Knights of the Golden Circle.
Exactly.
Their work was exactly the same. It was guerrilla shadow work, going out and blowing up train tracks, like holding up trains, robbing.
It was kind of like
robbing Union supply lines. Things like that.
It was
that.
Almost like a Confederate special forces.
Yeah.
And that's that. He excelled at that. He was very good at what he did. All the guerrillas were. And then after the war, they were the only groups that weren't granted amnesty like the rest of the Confederacy. So they were outlaws. If you've ever seen the movie The Outlaw Josie Wells, that's a very good description of, you know, they were hunted down like dogs and killed. So I guess he had two choices, in my opinion. He could have left the country and moved somewhere else, you know, just completely left. Or he had to stay and fight. He chose the latter, and he fought, and they started robbing banks. But it tied in. I think it was more than just robbing banks, and it wasn't for their own gain. It was for some purpose. And I thought, okay, that sounds just like the Knights of the Golden Circle. But this template, I started researching, and I'm getting ahead of myself, but
it's all right.
Back to the treasure map that passed down. I'd seen that treasure, you know, I'd seen the map. I didn't know where. I knew it was somewhere around his house in Blevins, Texas, but I wasn't sure where. So a few years later, and this all happened over many years, we met Wagner Carr. He was a former attorney general for the state of Texas. He contacted my mother, and Wagner Carr, by the way, was friends with LBJ. And he was also on the Warren, part of the Warren Commission.
Oh, wow.
Who investigated the assassination of Kennedy. I never get into that area. I don't want to know. that's not part of my story, but it was an item of interest I like to bring up. Wagner Carr was also interested in Jesse James and the gold. And he contacted my mother. They became friends over a year, 2 years. They started talking all the time. He wanted her to write his autobiography, but she was busy writing one of her other books. I think it was her second book. But he had his driver. He sent his driver out to pick my mother and I up and show us where several of the other known treasures were that were recovered by the state of Texas. According to Wagner Carr and his driver, while they were being recovered, they were guarded by Texas Rangers. And I had no reason to doubt that. I know there was a treasure dig back in the 70s in Waco, and it was surrounded by Texas Rangers. So I asked him where the treasure went. He never would answer that question. But they showed us the locations where these treasures were. And I thought, okay, now I've got three locations that, according to Wagner Carr and his driver, and then I know where Jesse lived in Blevins. I got the template, turned it into a transparency, put it on Google Earth, and everything lined up with the template where all the treasures were located. In the meantime, we also were contacted by a man named George Roaming. He was a former World War II vet, 32nd degree Scottish Rite Freemason. And when he was a kid, he knew Jesse when Jesse was old. Jesse died in 1943. George was, I think he was 86 in 2005, around that time when he passed away. I can't remember the exact year George passed. But when he was a child, he was around 10 to 11 years old. Jesse swore to an oath, him and two other boys, and hired George to help him move 700 bars of gold from Blevins, Texas, out near Belton, Texas. And George, he swore to an oath. George kept the oath. He said after World War II, the old men were dead. He helped Jesse with the gold. They drove about 20 miles away towards Belton, Texas, near where the lake is, which is now on Fort Hood property. They delivered the gold, buried the gold 8 foot deep, and that was it. They'd all sworn oath to secrecy. He lied about his age. He was 16 when he went to World War II, and when he came back, the two other boys who helped him bury the gold died in the war, and the old men had died of old age, including Jesse. So he said he kept the secret, and he was out in El Paso, called my mother and I to go visit him in the hospital, and he drew a map out for us, told us right where it was. So we went to look for it, and it's on Fort Hood's property. I told him I wasn't hopping a fence onto a military base looking for anything. So he just kind of shook his head, and that was that. Yeah, I don't want to end up in a no telling what. Where
you don't jump fences in Texas, much less military fences.
It's a good way to get shot.
Either way, it's a good way to get shot.
So, but the good thing is, with George's location and Wagner Carr's locations that he showed this, or his driver, everything matched on the template perfectly. So I had the template. I thought, okay, this shows where all the other locations are on that template. Each template has 33 locations. And then I got curious. I started wondering if it tied in with any other legends. So I was playing with the template, and I, left the one template where it was on Google Earth. And then I placed another one next to it in all sides of it, and it makes a grid pattern. And I kept going. Every place it went, there were a lot of places where it ties in with old treasure legends, including, this took forever. It wasn't overnight by any means, but it lines up with the Los Lunas Decalogue stone in New Mexico, which has ancient Jewish writing that the Indians claim was there before they were there.
Oh, wow.
It lines up with Scott Wolter's the rune stone up in Kensington, which Scott Wolter has written about. Mm-hmm. It lines up with Oak Island area. Also, the Newport Tower in Rhode Island. There's a lot of treasure areas where it lines up. And I thought, this is amazing. It's not just treasure sites. It's also areas of historical interest and mysterious areas like the Los Lunas Decalogue stuff.
Well, and things like, once again, Oak Island and the Newport Castle. Because Newport Castle specifically, I was telling you before the show, David S. Brody, we have him on the show regularly. He has a series about Newport Castle. And all of the symbology in it. We've definitely talked with Gretchen Cornwall about the Templar symbology that's there. So the fact that this map, whenever you put the template over it, pointed to two places that have possible Templar ties.
Yeah.
That's pretty incredible.
I wanted to, when I found that out, you know, just over time,
it
begged the question, why? Why the dimensions on the template? I wanted to know why so many miles. For, you know, there's three templates. It's a large, medium, and small template. The large one's 161 miles across, and then then there's a medium template and a smaller one. Every number on the dimensions of these templates lined up with sacred geometry, different meanings, Kabbalistic meanings. And there's another template that this one I call the Veil template. The one I'm talking about, it's a grid system, but it's kind of a crosshatch look. It covers another template that is in the shape of the Kabbalistic tree of life. It runs from Williamsburg, Virginia, at all near the Bruton Parish vault, which is a whole nother, that's a church actually, but there's a vault found by Manly Palmer Hall's wife. Manly Palmer Hall was a famous 33rd degree Mason, and a lot of people claim the father of the New Age.
Yeah.
Thought.
I'm showing
his
that
wife, Marie Bauer Hall.
Showing that map people, on screen right now.
Okay. Marie Bauer Hall was his wife. I believe it was her second husband was Manly Palmer Hall. Anyway, she had discovered through the writings of Shakespeare, she found encrypted messages. She claimed that Shakespeare was their patsy, basically. Sir Francis Bacon, in her opinion, was the real Shakespeare. There's a lot of other people who claim that it was actually Sir Francis Bacon and some of his peers. But either way, she found encrypted writings and symbols in various works from Shakespeare and another guy. I can't remember the name of John Wither, I believe is his name, which led her to Williamsburg, Virginia, specifically the Bruton Parish Church. She said she found the original foundations of this church, which weren't, it was near, but it wasn't the same church building that's there now. People said she was wrong. She didn't know what she's talking about. She proved them wrong. She unearthed the original foundations and proved them wrong. And she found it through the writings, the codes that she deciphered, and anagrams on fake headstones in the cemetery there in Williamsburg, Virginia. And then she went further and claimed that it led to a vault 22 feet beneath the original church where the altar was, and that the vault contained information that would shake the foundations of accepted history, world history. And they would not let her. At first, she was granted permission to dig, and then almost instantly, right after she was granted permission, somebody shut it down. They put her in jail for a short time in Williamsburg and then ran her out of town, told her, don't come back.
Wow.
And that's that. She claimed, and I've heard other people just reading it, they said the Rockefellers bought most of the town. They don't own Bruton Church, but they control the board of directors for the church. And that's just it. According to her, that's what put a stop to all of that. But the template I'm talking about in the Tree of Life shape runs from Williamsburg, Virginia at the Bruton Parish Church to Victorio Peak, New Mexico, which was a treasure was found in the 30s, late 30s. Back then, it amounted in the 30s and 40s, it amounted to over $3 billion in gold. And that was back then when gold was $32 an ounce, roughly. So I don't know what it would be worth today. That treasure is also mentioned in the Watergate hearings. So you know it's got legs on that story. if it's mentioned in the Watergate hearings, and LBJ also had interest in it as well. And shortly after that treasure came to light, White Sands Missile Range extended the range, which encompassed Victoria Peak, where the treasure was found.
Yeah.
And there's also documentaries on that. But to make a long story short, you've got the Tree of Life. And I thought, well, why are there two templates? Why is there a grid system? And then in addition to that, there's a Tree of Life, which led me to Kabbalah and a lot of other esoteric traditions. When you start researching the Tree of Life just for spirituality reasons, it accompanying that is another, it's called the three veils of negative existence. And that's where the grid system comes in. It's a large, medium, and small. It's three veils or grids, and they overlay the Tree of Life. And it tied in perfectly. I explain it better, in more detail in my book. But at first I wondered, did I just stumble on another treasure template that has nothing to do with the original? And then I found out later they tie in perfectly. Deals with Freemasonry, the Knights Templar, and Kabbalah, and also Middle Eastern mysticism. I hope I'm not rambling. I feel like I'm rambling when I'm talking about
you
this.
You are not rambling whatsoever. Especially for my audience who is used to this fractal concept. Literally you have to learn to be able to see the strands and the web, so to speak, the forest and the trees, as well as the path amongst it, you know.
I've always had a hard time. It's trying to condense, 25 years of research into just a short time. It's even hard condensing it into a book sometimes. But on top of, I discovered the dimensions, the meanings behind them, Kabbalistic and esoteric meanings behind all these various dimensions of the treasures, the treasure template. And I wanted to know who, the next question is who, what, when, where, and why. I wanted to know who was responsible for it. And all my research tied in with Freemasons and then back to, I wanted to know who came up with the template. And that was just a burning question with me. And Jesse played a big part. He played the night of, he was an important part in his day. But in the scheme of things, after I concluded the research, he was just a small part of a giant machine. Mm. There were other outlaws, pirates, Jean Lafitte.
Oh, yeah.
He was part of it. Doing the research, it went back through Freemasonry to some of the founding fathers, past them all the way back to Sir Francis Bacon. And when I came to him, I thought, okay, this guy was known as the father of modern day Freemasonry. And I was satisfied for a few days. And then I realized John Dee, the famous alchemist the guy was a spy. He was the original 007.
Yeah.
Just all kinds of that guy was amazing, but he was Sir Francis Bacon's mentor.
Yep.
And it led me on the second half of that trail went through John Dee, various other famous and kind of unknown alchemists, back to Jewish rabbis, through a long line of Jewish rabbis, Abraham Abulafia, back to a man named Rashi. He was a Jewish rabbi, famous Jewish rabbi. They called him Rashi. He was the favored court guest of Hugh, the Count of Champagne. And that was one of the founders of the Knights Templar. And I thought, I finally found my answer. And that when I found that, I was satisfied with who started this. It all stemmed from Kabbalah and other esoteric mindsets and thinking throughout the ages.
Yeah, and it's interesting because whenever we talked with Kathleen Ball about her work with the Knights Templar in Brazil, things like that, whenever we've talked with Gretchen Cornwall, even Graham Phillips about his work into the Templars, it all traces back to esoteric teachings.
It does.
And they used the sacred geometry in their building. They used that same symbology all over the place in their stained glass work, in all kinds of artwork. So it literally is a symbologic code that is around for identification for the initiated. You yourself are a Freemason.
Yes.
There's very much the same thing with them Freemasonry, where there's, if you walk around local buildings, especially in older towns, you'll see all kinds of Masonic symbolism. You just have to know what it means.
Exactly. In fact, before I left Marshall, Texas yesterday, but before last Saturday, I was in Jefferson, Texas, right up the road from Marshall. Mm. And I was on the courthouse steps looking at the windows on the courthouse. And that a lot of courthouses around the country, especially here in Texas, but everywhere, they have what it looks like just a nice little design in the windows, but it's symbolic of the Stone of Foundation.
Mm.
There's a lot of meaning. Yeah. And if you don't know, I mean, you can, a lot of that's not secret knowledge. It was at one time, but now you can go online or read some books find out a lot about that. It's just interesting. And most people walk by not knowing, not even thinking about it.
One of my favorite places in the country is the museum in Lexington, Massachusetts. They have an entire Masonic wing. And
I'd love to go to that.
It is phenomenal. I mean, like huge stained glass Masonic pieces. You walk in, they've got the original lithographs of like George Washington in his Masonic garb, all kinds of things. And it really does break down quite a bit of the, at least the public symbology that's there. That is, like you said, at this point, pretty well known. At one point, it was all very anathema secret, things like that. But as anybody would say, they are a society with secrets, not a secret society.
That's exactly right.
Everybody pretty well knows about them, so they aren't secret.
That's true.
like they got buildings and signs as you come into town. Like welcoming you.
Yeah.
So they aren't secret.
And they adopt highways for highway cleanup.
but it's interesting to see that you were not a Mason when you began this work, when you began this research. You weren't a Mason through a familial line or something like that, where like your father was a Mason. So, you know, because he went to meetings on Wednesday night. Sounds like something you should do.
Yeah.
This research brought you to that point of discovery within yourself.
That's exactly right. I know Jesse was a Mason under his alias anyway. And I believe Jesse was also a Mason before he lived under his alias, you know, as Jesse, but, he was a Mason. I know one of his grandsons, actually, one of his sons became a Mason. One of his grandsons, my grandfather was a Mason, but my dad wasn't. My research is exactly what led me to that. I wanted, you know, just searching for more answers and reading about Albert Pike. He's often demonized by a lot of people. I don't believe he was a bad person at all, personally. He had written, in some of his writings, he had said the beautiful thing about symbols is they have multiple meanings.
Yeah.
And, you know, the initiate can know one meaning, but he doesn't know the rest of them until you go through the steps and then you start learning multiple meanings for a lot of different symbols.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And as you move through the ranks, you learn even different meanings for the symbols, like you said. And sometimes that even is sometimes the new meaning you learn even destroys the old meaning entirely.
Exactly. What you thought was truth at one point turns out to not have been truth at all, but it was a necessary step to lead you towards the truth.
That point, that small point of revelation was what opened the keyhole to the door.
Exactly.
And it really is. It's interesting. I've considered numerous times trying to find a Masonic chapter to join, because it really is, when it comes down to it, that search for truth, that search for light, that that point of discovery of not only self, but where the self lies within the whole, you know, not just within you, but within the world around you. So now, with you being a Mason, with Jesse being a Mason, with, like you said, the Mason telling you that you've really got something here. It seems as though, or not the Mason, but the Knights Templar, the head of the Knights Templar, saying that it really seems like you've got what would be an accounting of the Templar treasure, or at least part of the Templar treasure. What was known to have been held by the Templars at one point. With that in play, with you being a Mason, any warnings from up on high, Daniel?
None from any Masons. Okay. My late mother and I were warned, but it wasn't by Freemasons. I could take that back. Actually, we've been warned by a couple of people. Let me do this chronologically.
Please.
When my late mother and I would take her down to the state archives in Austin as often as I could. And, you know, anytime she wanted to go, when I had some free time, I would take her down there. And every time we went, there was a period where we were there at least once a week. And two men followed us. We started noticing every time we were there, these same two men were there, and they were always watching us, but didn't. Yeah,
ooh, that's not
for some reason. We thought, well, maybe it's a coincidence. We didn't really think a lot about it.
Yeah.
Until one day we walked into the archives, went to sign our names. And the librarian, who we've got to know very well, he told us, don't sign that. And Mom said, why? You've told us to sign this every time in the past. He said, they're watching. Don't sign it. And we both looked at each other like,
who's watching?
You know, who's watching? And he said nothing. He just turned around and went and sat down. He said, just don't sign it. So we didn't sign it. And we walked in. And those same two men who had watched us in the past came up, they came to our table, and one man was a former Dallas police officer. His name was Jay Harrison. I'll just go ahead and say it. He's passed away.
Okay.
He was a Dallas police officer a couple of blocks away from JFK's assassination. And again, I don't like getting into that area. I don't think my story ties in with that. And if it did, I wouldn't want to know.
So, yeah. Yeah.
There's too many other things I'm interested in, but he wasn't a real nice guy, but he was kind of like a funny. He spoke in riddles. He never said anything straight out. It's like everything he said was a riddle, and he wasn't really friendly, but he wasn't mean either. Not overtly mean. His partner was a researcher for the Texas State Bar, But the first time we met him, his partner said that he was a house painter. And I thought, okay, you're a house painter. I don't know why you're following us around all the time. But they warned us not to mention any names that tied in with the Texas power structure. And my mother and I, you know, we were so naive at the time. It was like, well, who's the Texas power structure? And they both just kind of smiled and laughed a little and said, you'll find out. And no one from that day forth has ever come to us and said, we're part of the Texas power structure. So we've never really found out, you know, exactly. We have theories, but so he warned us on that. And then he took us out to a graveyard and showed us some names in the Texas State Cemetery, but he never said why he was showing us these certain headstones. To this day, I have no clue what he was getting at. But he had warned us. He said, you don't want to mess with the Texas power structure. And that's all he said. He died of cancer. The other guy we found out later was a researcher for the Texas State Bar. But in this jump years ahead, I mean, just a few years ago, a movie came out with Robert De Niro. I don't know if you remember it. It was about Jimmy Hoffa. and The Killing of Jimmy Hoffa. I can't remember the name of the movie, but Robert De Niro played an assassin in the movie, and I'm watching the movie, and Hoffa calls him and says on the phone, "I hear you paint houses." And I thought, oh my God, maybe that's what the guy meant. I don't know, but it just kind of sent a chill up my spine. I still don't know if that's what they were, but they warned us and then they disappeared. And that was that. We never saw them again. We kept our word. We didn't mention any names that we knew of that tied in with the Texas power structure. And then later on, a man started calling my mother. He helped a lot, gave a lot of information that we couldn't have found any other way, and it helped piece a lot of the puzzle together. But I don't really know if he was a Mason or if he wasn't. I think he is, but I'm not sure, and we've never even met the man face to face.
Wow.
And that's it's just strange stuff like that. I've had one person liken it to the Men in Black kind of thing. I've read about Men in Black. I don't think it's to that level, but you never really know.
You know what I've never heard of in a Men in Black story? Being stalked to the friggin' library.
Yeah.
So that's some hardcore business, man, when they're following you to the library on the
regs. Every time. And then there were people who would follow
us. And when the librarian's like, "Hey, man, just so you know, don't sign that. They've been watching you."
Well,
who?
Yeah,
you know, them. Like, what?
Them.
Them. You know.
It was weird. When the librarian comes up and warns you not to sign because you're being watched, that's
wow.
That was odd. That was an odd moment. So
That's incredible.
We were followed at one point by private detectives that were hired by the same group that sent us the death threats, but that was a whole, that was nothing on that level. Living in the country, and when you have dogs, it's kind of, you know, the
kinda
dogs
hard
warn
to sneak
you when
up.
People are around. Exactly.
It's not exactly like living in the city where they get used to every sound that's around them and they're just.
Exactly.
Meh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Out in the middle of nowhere, and we had five dogs. So,
yeah, hearing something is excitement at that point.
Yeah.
The reason I ask is because, and I guess the last question I would have for you, Daniel, is, so how long have you had the treasure in your possession?
I don't have the treasure.
You sure?
And I know this sounds corny. I would love to find a treasure. I don't know who wouldn't want to find a treasure.
Yeah.
And you read about these. I see them on Facebook all the time on the archaeology pages.
Mm.
Some guy just bought a brand new metal detector, never touched one in his life.
Yeah.
Goes out into a field and uncovers a historic Roman hoard of gold that's, you know, worth millions of pounds, British pounds. And I think that lucky SOB, you know?
Yeah.
But on the same token, the treasures that I was researching, I truly... And I know it sounds corny, I think they're meant not for one person. They're meant for the country or a greater purpose at the very least.
Mm.
And I know for a fact, some of the large ones anyway are watched. And I know that for a fact.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow.
But I would love to find one. But yeah, I thought, why can't I just stumble on something that doesn't have all these purposes and meanings behind it?
and that's because of course that's got to be the first thing people ask whenever you go. Well, yeah, you know, the family treasure maps and casual, because it's very casually mentioned. The family treasure maps, Daniel.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, like,
you know, it's weird, you know, when your reality,
it's like the family Bible,
very strange,
you know,
my family's had treasure maps. I grew up with,
I think my crazy cousin got them. He's a prank.
It is a weird, it is strange. I got to thinking about that not too long ago, just
that
laughing.
Is surreal.
It's my reality. I grew up knowing this. My mom grew up knowing that. All my cousins, you know, they hear it. It's just a reality. It's like, oh yeah, the family treasure.
And
but most people don't think. A lot of people don't have that, and it is an odd thing. I don't go out in public telling people about my
Well, because once again, if you think you got threats at the archive.
Oh, yeah.
Not even looking for the treasure. Not trying to find additional parts of the map or anything like that. Like, that was still back in the day when you were looking things up with your mom.
Yeah.
You know, that wasn't like, hey, yeah, you know, I've now joined the Masons and I understand all this symbolism and I'm breaking it down and decoding everything. That's not why you were at the archives, you know.
That's true. We were just doing genealogy at that point.
Yeah.
And that was enough to raise some red flags for somebody.
Exactly.
And I was also told, mentioning that, talking about treasure and stuff, I have a friend in the UK. She was in London for a while. She's a editor of the Square magazine. It's a free online Masonic magazine. But she had warned me when I wrote the first book. She said, just be prepared. Anytime you write about treasure and esoteric topics, you're going to get nutcases from out of the woodwork. And I've had a few. I had one lady from Arizona tell me that she needed my blood to open a portal. And I thought, oh my God, what have I brought on myself?
Wow.
So, yeah, it was some odd stuff. But.
Well, yeah. And, you know, there's, once again, numerous stories of treasure in Texas, things like that. Go to cross over to Galveston. And there's a historic marker there. Me and my brother, for the longest time, when we saw a historical marker, like, we just stopped. We read it. It was wild, some of the things that you'll find at just like random little corners passing a field. But right there, that one, as you pass the, just before you go over the causeway to get to Galveston Island, you'll read that Jean Lafitte, the pirate, defended that area right there.
That's true.
So yeah, there's pirate booty, Civil War gold, all kinds of things here in Texas. Mexican gold. It's pretty phenomenal. And once again, when you to know that you were warned away from things when you were just on the cusp of your research with your family, imagine what it would be. I mean, gold hunters get threatened all the time. Claims get threatened and jumped all the time. It can be a pretty dangerous thing prospecting for such stuff, despite the ones that are guarded on federal property, what have you.
Yeah.
You know, there are people.
That's another reason. That's another reason I gave the directions on how to make your own template, how to build it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Don't come to me trying to make my template. The directions are in the book.
They are. They're right there. I was just showing them on air a little while ago. It is the intricacies of this book are absolutely amazing. The information that you have coalesced together in this.
Thanks.
Phenomenal, Daniel. Phenomenal. For somebody who, like, historical research was, it's not like you have a degree in that. It's not like, you know, that is what you do. This is something that a familial story took you down a rabbit hole and you have just continued to dig.
It turns into multiple rabbit holes. That's for sure. It's enough for a lot more than one lifetime of research.
And I want you to know, Daniel, whenever you're ready to dig, you let me know.
Okay.
I'll be there.
All right. Sounds good.
I'll help you with that. I want to thank you for your time, man. I know. And once again, happy birthday. It is actively your birthday today as we are pre-recording this. Thank you so much for your time on such an important day in life. Hope you have a good one.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it. Now, it's an honor being on your show, and thanks for having me.
Always glad to have you on. I'm glad to have you on for a second time. We had a great time the first time around, and now that you're here locally, we definitely need to get together soon. Before you hop off the air real quick, let everybody know where they can go to follow your work, where they can go other than our store, of course, to pick up your books, everything else.
Well, the books are available anywhere books are sold, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, Books A Million, basically anywhere books are sold in most countries around the globe. You can go to my website, authordanielduke.com. You can find me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and my publisher's website is innertraditions.com. And you can also go to simonandschuster.com and find the books there as well.
Fantastic. Daniel, thank you so much once again for your time. I greatly appreciate it. Please do hold the line while we close things out for the audience. While you are online checking out all of the amazing work of Daniel Duke over at the author, danieldeuke.com. Of course, folks, make sure to stop on by CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is where you can find our store, CuriousRealm.com/store. There are his books right there. That's where we have all the books from our authors. That's where we have films by the filmmakers that we interview. You can also go by CuriousRealm.com/story. And share your story of the paranormal. If you are a targeted individual, if you're a government whistleblower, stop on by, share your story and your evidence with us, and we will present it to our researchers whenever we have them on the show. Thank you so much once again, everybody, for tuning in as always. Take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and remember, stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault on our website, CuriousRealm.com. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast services, as well as YouTube, Roku, Amazon Fire, and Apple TV through the APR TV app, available on all app markets. Curious Realm is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more great content or to become a sponsor of Curious Realm or other podcasts, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.